Welcome to another week of Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arend.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. April 2nd.
Time April 2nd.
Flies. And we have a lot to talk about on the show today.
Okay, let's talk about it.
So a big chunk of our show will be dedicated to right to repair.
What's that?
Yeah, it's this idea that consumers should have a right to fix devices or products that they buy. Apparently, companies have made it very hard for us to fix, say, our iPhone on our own. We always have to go back to Apple or to a company or designated authorized repair shop, and they charge all this money, and we can't choose who repair our devices. Well, there is a growing movement across the country to put laws in places that will force manufacturers to give information and tools and parts to repair shops so that we can get things fixed.
That sounds like a great topic to discuss on a radio
Nathan
program.
Nathan Proctor leads a national effort. He'll be talking about that. We also have Shira Ward, a founder of a local repair shop, and we'll also have a state representative on the show who's going to be introducing a bill to have right to repair laws in Pennsylvania.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
We also are very much looking forward to our conversation at the end of the show today with local author Joe Piazza, who has written many books, but her latest is called The Sicilian Inheritance. It's a novel, fictional. It's a murder mystery, but it is inspired by the real life murder of her great-great-grandmother in Sicily. And she has spun that off into a podcast also called The Sicilian Inheritance that focuses on her great-great-grandmother's real-life story. So we have sort of two
y'all. It's juicy, okay?
A fictional one, a real one, and we're going to talk with her about those, but also just generally about Sicily and food and family and secrets and all of that good stuff.
I love a good family lore. Like, I love family lore, like all the stories that we tell each other and we pass down through the generations. I love it. So I'm looking forward to that. Also, if you have questions.
More than I bargained for there. There you go.
If you have questions about right to repair or want to comment about, share a story about trying to get something fixed, like your iPhone or
another device.
I
want someone to write in with their family lore now.
Oh, yeah. Or you have a family lore you want to share, email us, studio2@whyy.org.
I want to know what your family lore is.
I have some stories. Okay. We'll talk off mic. But today, I mean, infrastructure for the past week. And that'll be our top story. Avi, take it away.
Not news to anyone, I would imagine, but a section of I-95 northbound is closed after a tractor trailer carrying an oversized load damaged a railroad bridge in the Port Richmond section of Philadelphia. Northbound lanes shut down now, perhaps for the next few days. Thankfully, no injuries reported. However, this is causing a real traffic snafu on the roads and the rails. The Atlantic City Rail Line remains suspended in both directions between Philadelphia 30th Street and Cherry Hill because of that bridge strike. So to help us understand what's happening now and what will be happening over the next few days, we have rung up a CBS News Philadelphia's traffic reporter, Chandler Lutz. Chandler, welcome back to Studio 2.
Hi, Cherry. Hi, Avi. Thanks for having me. I was just thinking about it. The last time I spoke to you was last June of 2023 when we had the 95 collapse, where we were dealing with the same kind of issue. We have a major highway in Philadelphia now closed, and as you can imagine, a lot of detours and a lot of ways to get around it.
Yeah.
We like having you on the show, but we kind of wish.
I know it wasn't because of this.
Yeah.
But got to ask you, Chandler, where exactly is this closure and how is it impacting traffic?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, a truck hit a section of the Conrail Bridge Monday at about 1:30 in the afternoon. And this is right near the Betsy Ross Bridge there. So traffic right now on 95 northbound, all traffic is forced off onto the Betsy Ross Bridge, Aramingo Avenue interchange. That's exit 26.
Okay.
And then everything is back on right around Bridge Street. So that's the stretch of 95 northbound. That's the closure there you're going to see.
And what do you think is the best way to get around it? Just do the normal detours? Are those okay for right now? Or are you perhaps proposing some alternative routes?
So this happened yesterday afternoon, and we saw, you know, we had the Phillies game, the drive home, and then we had the morning commute this morning. And let me tell you, we saw major delays on 95 northbound. Usually for the morning commute, we have heavier delays southbound. A lot of folks are heading into the city, but today, 95 northbound was just a parking lot. So detours, they are set up. I'll tell you the detour just so you can kind of visualize it here. As you get off on exit 26, you make a right onto Aramingo Ave instead of making the turn to go onto the Betsy Ross Bridge, of course. Then you can make a right on Adams Ave, and then you can get back onto 95 northbound via the ramp at Adams Avenue. But the big problem is just getting to that detour. The delays pouring onto 95 northbound just to get off at exit 26. I mean, they were miles backed up this morning, and this evening for the drive home, I can only imagine is going to be very heavy. I would really just expect delays starting at even Center City, South Philadelphia. So I've been telling a lot of our viewers, and I want to tell your listeners, that there's different alternates, of course, you can take to 95 northbound. Think about traveling locally. You know, you have Torresdale Ave, Frankfort Ave, Richmond Street if you're traveling in the Northeast. We were talking to a lot of drivers this morning who were also just getting off at Girard Avenue. Anything to just not deal with the delays on 95 north. But then think about just staying west of Center City. You have the Schuylkill westbound. Then you can travel north on Roosevelt Boulevard. Roosevelt Boulevard, of course, is an alternate to 95 for both directions there. And also don't rule out a trip into New Jersey. You can take the Ben Franklin Bridge. You can take the Walt Whitman over and take northbound of the Jersey Majors. You have Route 130, you have 295, you even the New Jersey Turnpike. And depending on where you're traveling, you can get back onto 95 northbound via the area bridges. You have the Bessie, Tacony, Palmyra. And even if you want to continue up north, you have the Turnpike Connector Bridge. So definitely a lot of alternates. I know it's definitely going to make the commute tougher. You have to think it through. It's not just as easy as hopping on 95 north now because we're going to see these major delays for the next several days. That is what PennDOT is saying. Several days we're going to see this closure in place.
Wow. Well, Chandler, I think you nailed it. I mean, people just have to be patient, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Pack your patience, as I like to say.
Wonderful.
That is Chandler Lutz, CBS News Philadelphia's traffic reporter, giving us all the details we need to deal with a massive, massive closure on I-95 northbound right now because of that earlier crash with a tractor-trailer colliding with a railroad bridge in the Port Richmond section of the city. Chandler Lutz, thanks again for joining us on Studio 2.
Thank you.
Wonderful. So, yeah, we just have to, we take all of these roads for granted, I swear.
Mm-hmm.
And so good luck if you are on the road right now. And hopefully you wrote down or put a pen in it on those detours. So moving on to our next story, a new report, Avi, details the tens of millions of dollars that Pennsylvania could rake in if recreational marijuana becomes legal in the Commonwealth. Now, it has some lawmakers, some who were opposed to legalized weed, opening the door to possibly or maybe reconsidering it again.
Interesting.
Let me tell you how this all started. So Governor Shapiro's budget proposal predicted that the Commonwealth could bring in more than $14 million in revenue from recreational marijuana in the first year of legalization. Then the Pennsylvania Independent Fiscal Office, they analyzed that proposal, and they found that the governor's number was very low. The IFO estimates that Pennsylvania could, in fact, rake in $41 million the first year of legalization. And the market, once it got fully operational, it could balloon to an estimated $271 million by fiscal year 2028-29. It's unclear why there was such a big discrepancy between those two numbers. But according to the Inquirer article that we read today, some GOP lawmakers are now saying, well, I mean, given all the money that's on the table and given the fact that we're kind of between states that allow recreational weed, we have to at least consider it and see what would happen. Your thoughts?
Well, that's the key, right? Because those other states that you're referencing, Delaware, New Jersey, Democrat-controlled states, this is generally an issue in which Democrats tend to be a little bit more gung-ho than most Republicans, not all.
Mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania is a totally different landscape.
It is.
Republican leaders need to be on board for this to happen. If they are signaling that they might be on board, then this might happen.
Yeah. And it's just a lot of money. It's just like, and there's...
It is. Although in the context of a state budget, I don't want to say
billions.
It's a drop in the bucket, but it's not like... It was interesting for me to read that Republican state leaders were reconsidering on money grounds. I mean, this is not like going to plug your fiscal hole forever. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just sort of a justification because they think this is going to happen anyways. Mm-hmm. It is a lot of money, but it's also not a lot of money. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, if, you know, a lot of folks are reconsidering a lot of things just because a lot of that federal money from the pandemic is going away. Right. And that was a crutch for a lot of folks. And so now they're going to have to look at the real revenue that's coming in. And this could be a new source.
I mean, that's the story of vice taxes, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's lottery, whether it's mm-hmm. alcohol, whether it's weed, it's something to fall back on mm-hmm. when you don't want to raise taxes and you don't want to cut programs.
How do you create new streams of revenue?
Yeah,
weed.
Totally. A lot of people are throwing their money mm-hmm. into pickleball these days.
Oh, are they now?
They are. Pickleball mm-hmm. is, I am told, soaring in popularity.
Mm-hmm.
What is pickleball? You know, it's that little paddle game that mm-hmm. kind of looks like a shrunken version of tennis. Is that enough of a description for people? It makes a...
Mm-hmm.
You see people playing pickleball. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyways, Central Jersey, Mercer County, Robbinsville specifically, a developer says they are building the largest pickleball facility in the Mid-Atlantic, 20 indoor pickleball courts. Pickleball, Cherry. It's happening.
It's blowing up. We might have to, get a game going or something. We at least need to try. I feel like we should try.
You've never played it?
I've never played it.
I don't understand why some people hate it, because there is a lot of pickleball hate as much as there is.
Because of the noise.
Is it just the noise? Well, this would be indoors, so they mm-hmm. can't be upset about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a little noisy, but there are so many noisy things in the world. It puzzles me that people seem so worked up about pickleball mm-hmm. in both directions. It mm-hmm. seems like a fine game. Let me propose something.
Mm.
We're a young show.
Yes. Just turn one.
We could use some publicity. We could really, benefit from riding the wave of something that's
like pickleball.
Like pickleball. I mm-hmm. think a lot of our listeners probably play pickleball. There mm-hmm. might be some demographic overlap. Should we sponsor a pickleball team or facility?
Yeah, well,
I feel like that would work for us.
Or at least get a t-shirt.
At least a t-shirt.
I think, I'm really into the gear. Like, what does the gear look like? What are the outfits?
Some branded gear. Yeah. Some branded Studio 2 pickleball mm-hmm. gear. We could have a team called the Studio 2
Pickleballers.
Pickleballers, Gherkins, the Dills,
The Koshers, I don't know.
Yeah, like. I just think it could work. I think there's a lot. There's the Venn diagram of Studio 2 and pickleball has a healthy overlap. And I think we could exploit that moving forward. Just something to think about for our bosses.
Something to think about. And coming up, the fight for the right to repair your own technology. It's gaining momentum around the country and in our region. Are you a fix-it type person? If you are, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whrod.org. We'll be right back.
Go Studio 2 Gherkins.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Cherry, I know you've got a story to share about getting your cell phone fixed in an unusual way.
Yeah, I smashed my screen, called up a buddy who came over. A buddy who came to the station, fixed my screen, replaced it for like $10.
$10?
It would have cost me $50 for my deductible if I'd taken it back to T-Mobile to get it fixed.
And it worked.
It worked. And it worked just fine. It's perfect. Yeah, it's great.
Dare I ask how you smashed it in the first place? That's a story for
another
time.
Day. Okay. Another day. Bad story.
But your story about fixing it is really at the heart of the right to repair movement, which wants tech companies, smartphones, smartwatches, laptops, iPads, etc., to make their devices easier to repair.
Mm-hmm.
So you could fix your busted iPhone screen yourself or take it to an independent repair shop or call up your buddy.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be a lot of momentum behind this effort, with 4 states recently passing laws. There are also bills in New Jersey, Delaware, one in the Pennsylvania Senate, and another one coming to the PA House, all on this topic. Here to tell us more about why we should be able to fix our own stuff is Nathan Proctor. He leads the Public Interest Resource Group's Right to Repair campaign. Nathan, welcome to Studio 2.
Hello, it's wonderful to be here.
And folks, we want you to join us. Do you think companies should be required to make technology more repairable? give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
So, Nathan, my story is a few years old, and a lot has changed since then. And I had kind of heard about this right to repair, but knew very little until I prepped. So lay out the problem that this movement, this right to repair movement, seeks to solve.
Sure. Well, I think you've experienced the problem that many people have, which is you have some piece of technology that breaks or doesn't work right. And, you know, you realize that the only way to get it fixed is to contact the manufacturer and talk to their authorized repair provider, that nobody else has the parts, tools, or increasingly the software necessary to return the device to working order. And so right to repair legislation basically tries to remove those barriers to repair. Acquire the companies, if they have repair materials like, you know, manuals, special service software, any spare parts, that they make those available to independent repair shops and to consumers who feel like doing it themselves.
So what's the state of play now? Like if I'm running a shop that fixes technology, let's say smartphones, the manufacturer just doesn't even give me the tools I need to fix it?
Well, this had started happening across all sectors. And at this point, you probably can get some of those parts, tools, and information for the smartphone specifically because of all the progress that we've had, and these bills have passed in other states. But there's a lot of other kinds of technology which you still can't get. Like if you have a DSLR camera, like a high-end digital camera, go online right now and check to see what repair manuals or spare parts you can get. There's nothing. And there used to be like camera shops in pretty much every major city, for sure. There'd be a number in a city like Philadelphia. Now, the manufacturers refuse to let people have those materials, and people can't fix their cameras anymore. And it's turned into, you have to ship it to the manufacturer, and then they take a month and a half, and they charge you, you know, an outrageous sum. It's inconvenient, it's expensive. And at the end of the day, a lot of people, when faced with all those barriers, they just replace the product because it's just, you know, at least they understand how that works.
Is it pure greed, Nathan? Is it just about money? Or could there be some other reasons why companies keep this proprietary information to themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure why they do it. I know the impact, right? I mean, I would say that there's a lot of incentives if you are a manufacturer to keep the repair process proprietary, because then you get to set the price, right? You know, and if you offer, you know, a protection plan, right? So if like you make people pay $300 so that you can cover their repairs in the future, like the price point of that repair plan really is, greatly increased if there's nobody else that can do the repair. It becomes more like a protection racket than a protection plan at that point.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of incentives to control the repair process. And of course, you know, the manufacturers will say, well, we want to curate the perfect experience for our users, and we don't want them to have a bad experience. But like your experience, Cherry, well, where your friend fixed it instantly for $10, like they're not making account for that. Sometimes that's exactly what we want and what we need and what we prefer. And the other piece is that, you know, when there's no competition and manufacturers, like they totally control it, you know, quality goes down the tubes, right? They're not compete. There's no repair shop out there doing it better and faster and doing a more diverse range of repairs. So they start to get worse and worse and worse, which is what we'd seen for a long time in this industry and appliances. And now I think with the right to repair starting to make progress, hopefully that's turning around, but it's got to move faster.
And I want to bring in Shura Ward, owner of Girls Fix It, a local repair shop here in Philadelphia. They fix phones, computers, iPads, Apple Watches. Shura, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, Sherry. Thanks so much for having me to discuss this very important topic that we need Pennsylvania to get through.
Yeah, for sure. And so just talk a little bit about your business. What do you all fix, and what has that experience been like for you?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we do fix cell phones, tablets, laptops, and smartwatches as well. And the thing about it is what some of the manufacturers has even done is they put proprietary software within the devices so that way even when, for example, an iPhone screen is changed, the consumer will get a message basically saying this is not an iPhone part or Apple part, but this can even happen if it's a part we buy directly from Apple. But the thing about it is it's putting, you know, discouragement into the consumer for them to not go to third-party small businesses like myself and only go to Apple in this case, you know, to get their devices fixed, which of course makes business survival a little bit harder for small businesses like myself if they're kind of deterring customers based on these kind of error messages.
And you guys charge less. Talk about the cost. Because as I mentioned earlier in my little story, the deductible price was like $50, mm-hmm. whereas I got somebody to repair it for $10.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what's the differential for the consumer if they were to hire you versus going back to the manufacturer?
Yeah, in most cases, it's going to be probably at least 50% less in most mm-hmm. cases, depending on what the damage is. You know, of course, if something is water damage, you know, it needs a whole lot more repair work. But the screens, batteries, some of the general maintenance of these devices, it's at least 50% in most cases.
Sure. Give me a sense of what you can fix and what you can't fix right now. Let's say in the state of Pennsylvania, like an example of a problem, you can do the repair. And then an example of a problem where you cannot do the repair because of the hurdles created by the manufacturer.
Yeah, so I think the biggest challenge is, you know, in most cases we can do the repair. It's just finding the parts, you know. So I think that makes it the biggest challenge. And then if you do find the parts, they're astronomical. So you go back to charging what the manufacturer would charge. So in most cases, most things are repairable, but like I said, it's either hard to find the parts or it's going to be extremely expensive for the customer.
Wow. Let's bring in a caller now. This mm-hmm. is Holly, who wants to talk about something called Philly Fixers Guild. This might be something that you want to know about if you've got something that you need repaired. Holly, educate us. You're on Studio 2.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. I'm with Philly Fixers Guild, as you said. We hold these monthly repair fairs throughout the city, and we try to bring volunteer fixers together where they offer their skills to guests that bring in all sorts of different appliances or household products or, yeah, sometimes phones and other technology. And, yeah, they meet with a fixer and they just try to diagnose the repair that's needed. And just like the guest just said, too, it's a lot of times they have to bring in their own parts to replace, and they just try to work on it together, and sometimes they come back to the next event, but we just try to offer some knowledge and time too to these folks.
Interesting.
I love
Philly Fixers Guild, so perhaps a resource for folks out there. Thanks for the call, Holly.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
Yeah, and I want to bring in this comment from Bill, who says, my house is filled with older Apple Macintosh computers, specifically because I can do the work on them myself. Upgrading memory and hard drives have allowed me to keep machines far over a decade. It is impossible to do that with the new machines, though, and that is a problem. Nathan, I want to bring you back into the conversation because I want to talk a little bit about this idea of planned obsolescence. And, you know, we're almost forced, you talked about this, we're almost forced to buy new products or new machines or new devices when we shouldn't have to. How does this strategy work, and what is the cost to consumers?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have noticed that there's just an incredible increasing churn in the life cycle of basically all of our products. We're buying more and more devices at a faster and faster rate kind of all the time, in whether or not that's because they're not made as well or because there's restrictions to who can fix them and how, whatever it is, like the trend is really obvious. The UN studies e-waste. They have this huge report called the Global E-Waste Monitor, which came out 2 weeks ago. And it's a crisis. Electronic waste is growing 5 times faster than our recycling capacity. There's just nothing we recycle like 22% of global e-waste, and that's going to be the high watermark because the amount of new stuff that we're just dumping into the market is just unending. And so it's critical that we be able to use stuff for longer, and we need to put those incentives in place for manufacturers to make longer lasting stuff that we can fix. And unfortunately, right now, those those incentives just aren't there. Like, they like making quickly replaced products. You know, everything from dishwashers and washing machines to cell phones and tablets, everything, it's a combination of the software and the physical device breaking down faster, and then also not having options to fix it when it breaks. All of that is contributing to this crisis, which is also very expensive. You know, I did a report that looked at how much money we're spending on replacing devices. And if we actually fixed instead of replaced devices, so we got 50% more lifespan out of our products, that would save an average household $382 a year, which across Pennsylvania's many households is just about $2 billion wow. per year. And it's funny, you were talking about $171 million in, you know, new tax revenue from cannabis. And like, compare that to $2 billion in saving just by not throwing out and repairing the stuff that we use every day.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, the money that we are spending on repair is going to these businesses like Ms. Ward's.
So let's, I wanted to bring in one more email here. Philip, who says, I have an old 2012 MacBook Pro running on Linux. I wish we could all support open source software and reduce our e-waste a little bit more, sort of echoing what you said there, Nathan. I get the problem, but how do we legislate our way out of it, Nathan Proctor? I mean, I don't know if you could require a company to make it so your product lasts a certain amount of time. So what are the legislative solutions? What should they include? And maybe also, what should they not include?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing we need to deal with is this experience that people have where they like something breaks and then they just can't figure out how to get it fixed. And so they give up. That becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So the solution in the bill that we passed in other states is to the extent there is repair materials available, parts, tools, and documentation, that becomes available to anybody who wants it, the independent repair shop or the owner.
Yeah.
Also, if we require this to be made available, sometimes manufacturers get away with saying, oh, this particular thing can't be fixed. What they're not telling you is we fix absolutely nothing. Right. And I think that some manufacturers, when that information becomes more readily apparent, that will hurt their sales, which is really where, you know, where their motivation is going to come from. So we want to put some pressure, but that's not the only thing that can be done. But I think once people expect things to be fixed, that companies are going to want to meet those expectations. And I think that's a really important place to start.
Yeah. And there's an effort right here in Pennsylvania to push forward with right to repair legislation. To find out where it stands, we've called in Representative Kyle Mullins, who is working on a bill for the Pennsylvania House. He's a Democrat from Lackawanna County. Welcome to Studio 2.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me, everyone.
Yeah, so let's talk about the proposed bill that you're working on. What would it do?
Sure. It would get to the very issue that we're talking about. It would introduce a right to repair that would, in my view, is a consumer protection matter. It is an environmental matter in diverting waste from landfills and supporting small repair shops like we just heard about, and the people they employ, those talented technicians, to be able to repair what they are qualified and trained to do.
Representative Mullins, what are you sort of grappling with right now as you try to craft this legislation and get people on board? Where are you getting pushback? Are there certain categories of product you might exclude from this legislation? Give us a sense of the landscape.
Certainly. Well, the perspective from a lawmaker or one who tries to make laws and stop bad ideas from becoming laws is when you embark upon a proposal, when you float an idea out there, you really get a sense. First of all, you get a very deep understanding, subject matter understanding of just how broad a proposal could impact, how broadly something could impact across a host of industries. And we are, of course, we want to be on the side of consumers, of course, but we also want to be on the side of consumer safety, as well as respect those things that are of a proprietary nature or of a are sensitive or even life saving or sustaining technologies used in the healthcare industry, or be sensitive to the fact that farm equipment, if you choose to repair it on your own, could, depending on that circumstance, could be harmful, if not deadly, if something goes wrong and you don't know what you're doing. So what we did was how we float proposals is you issue a co-sponsor memo, which is sort of a general summary of what you intend to introduce. And we, just the last time we were in session in Harrisburg, we sought from the across the industry landscape testimony and heard from organizations and companies and manufacturers in support of the concept and those with concerns. So the best proposals are born out of compromise and it's all about getting enough votes to get something passed. So that's what we're in the process of doing as we craft the bill and its language.
Well, thank you so much. That was Representative Kyle Mullins, who's working on a bill for the Pennsylvania House that would hopefully push forward the right to repair here in Pennsylvania. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to read in one more email here from Robbie, who says, I have many vacuums that I use to clean my church property, and I always keep them maintained and in good use, but it's getting harder to repair them because the manufacturers are continually changing access to screws to open the vacuum. I think the manufacturers want you to replace the broken item with a new one. As we wrap up, Shura Ward, what does the future of your business look like, and how would your business change if right to repair became a reality here in Pennsylvania?
Oh, wow. That would be amazing. I think it would allow us to be a lot more sustainable and be able to grow even more than we've grown over the last 5 years, just because we'll be able to, you know, do more repairs and even maybe bring our prices down as well and even expand to additional electronic devices as well.
Mm. Well, we will leave it there, but perhaps much more to come on this topic. I want to thank everyone involved. Shura Ward, founder and owner of Girls Fix It, a local technology repair store. Nathan Proctor leads the Public Interest Resource Group's Right to Repair campaign. Thanks to both of you for joining us today on Studio 2.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And coming up next on Studio 2, local novelist Joe Piazza joins us to talk about her brand new book, The Sicilian Inheritance and the Long Ago Family Murder Mystery that inspired it all. You don't want to miss this. We will be right back with more Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2, home of the Gherkins. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Philadelphia author Joe Piazza has a brand new novel out today, The Sicilian Inheritance. It's a mystery set in Sicily. And if you like books featuring delicious food, stunning landscapes, dark family secrets, and murder, well, this one, friends, this one is for you. And speaking of murder, by the way, Piazza got the idea for her book from her own family history, the mysterious murder of her Sicilian great-great-grandmother. And investigating that story led her to her new true crime podcast, also named The Sicilian Inheritance.
Joe Piazza is a journalist and the author of several other novels, but you may also know her from her popular podcast, Under the Influence. It's a new podcast here. Under the Influence, which explores the power of mom influencers on social media. So this conversation could go in any number of directions. Joe joins us now in studio on her book launch day to talk about Sicily, murder mysteries, and a whole lot more. Joe Piazza, welcome to Studio 2.
I loved that intro, and we could talk about anything, guys. Like, this conversation could go so many different ways.
And I got to give you a congratulations with some jazz hands there for you. And thanks for being with us on launch day.
Yeah.
So tell us, we tried to give a brief introduction of the book. So give us your elevator pitch and then weave in there some of the reasons that excited you about writing it.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. So The Sicilian Inheritance, I wanted to write a delicious book. Mm-hmm. So I was really writing in during the heart of the pandemic when I was trapped in my house with two children and my husband. It was a lot. And I wanted to escape. I wanted to write an escapist adventure. And it's inspired by, as you said, the real life murder of my great-great-grandmother, Lorenza Marsala, mm-hmm. which my family has been playing a 100-year game of telephone, passing down this story. And we are very Italian American, which means that we love to tell stories and to make up stories and even sometimes to embellish stories, if you will. All I knew is that she was murdered before she could come to America to join her husband. And the two theories are that she was killed by the mafia or she was killed for being a witch.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to know more. I wanted to write fiction. I was like, all right, I'm taking that nugget and I'm going with it and writing this novel.
And that was the plan from the beginning. Yes. We're not going to get into the real life thing. We're just going to take this story as it was received and write a novel inspired by it. So first, let's talk about said novel. So we've got the two main characters. Mm-hmm. We have the character based on your great-great-grandmother. Mm-hmm. And then you have a contemporary woman who is a Philadelphian who is going through a rough time in her life and is trying to find answers and connections. So lay out the two main characters and how you decided to tell the story, kind of alternating between their two lenses.
Yeah, yeah. I knew that I wanted to tell the story in the past of a woman at the turn of the century, but I also wanted to transport all of us to Sicily in the present. So we have a modern day woman named Sarah Marsala who lives here in Philly. After moving home to Philly 5 years ago, I've decided I will set all of my books here in Philadelphia forever.
Good choice if you want to be on Studio 2.
Yes, I know what I'm doing here. It's good branding. And so she's a Philadelphia butcher and chef and also a mom of a young daughter. And it's not easy. It's not easy to be an ambitious chef, to own a restaurant, and also to be a present mother. And so her life is kind of a mess, but not because of the reasons we usually see women in books having messy lives. You know, they drink too much, they take pills, they're like mentally unstable. Sarah's life is a mess because it's hard to be a woman with ambition in the world, and it's hard to be a mother in the world. And she gets this deed that may or may not belong to her family, that may be land in Sicily. And she's told by when her own great aunt passes away, she says, you should go to Sicily and see if this land is worth anything. And if it is, sell it and rebuild your life. But most importantly, go have an adventure.
Yeah.
You need an adventure and you deserve it. And I think as women, we're not told enough that we deserve a break, that we deserve time off, and we deserve to go have that kind of adventure. So she does. And when she gets there, she learns about the mystery of her own great-grandmother Serafina's murder and tries to unravel it. And then in the past timeline, we travel back to the turn of the century. Serafina is a headstrong young woman. She wants more out of life than she can get in her small Sicilian village. But she gets pregnant young and has to get married and is forced into a life of being a wife and mother that she didn't really want. But she does it because that's what women did. And that's what women still do. And we follow her as her husband leaves to go to America. And when he's gone, she can finally realize some of her dreams. And she becomes a healer and a town doctor. And with so many men gone, and this is a true nugget in the book, I mean, a million men left Sicily for America around the turn of the century. This village is run mostly by women. And it's the women who band together to help each other, not just in life, but professionally and through everything.
Yeah, there's a great quote in the book.
Yes.
You write, the leaving was gradual.
I wrote that too.
Until one day the women looked around and realized we outnumbered the men. Mm-hmm. Fascinating sort of period to focus in Sicilian history.
Yeah, only the old men remained.
Old men.
And this is sort of opened the door, and you touched upon it, for women to sort of grow. And they had this unique independence in Sicily. Could you tell us a little about that? It was just so fascinating to me because it was a piece of history that I knew very little about.
Me too. And so that's the thing. I started writing the book based off this story in my family. And then I started doing a little bit of research. And that's when I discovered that so many women were taking on the men's jobs and they were learning to read for the first time and write for the first time. They were buying and selling land. And that's when the book got really interesting to me because I'm like, oh, I can write this delicious adventure, but oh, of course, it's got a feminist heart to it. So I just loved the idea of women finally having agency over their lives. And it being this slice of feminist Italian history that I had never heard about as an Italian American, most people I talked to had never heard about it. And I wanted to explore that idea and also explore what does it mean when you then have to rejoin your husband, because a lot of these women were called to America after about 5-10 years. And then they were, you know, kind of forced back into the home.
Yeah.
Because when we're talking about the turn of the century, too, it was amazing that women in Italy were buying and selling land, because they certainly weren't doing that very often in America.
Yeah.
Can we flip now to the real life story?
Oh, we sure can. We sure can.
Mm-hmm. Because your great great grandmother was supposed to eventually mm-hmm. come and join
she
her
was.
Husband and her family in America.
Mm-hmm.
Never made it. It was so fascinating to me listening to the first episode of your podcast about the real life story that your family members who passed down this story mm-hmm. about Lorenza are like titillated by it. It's not like a dark story to them.
Oh, no.
And the fact that there could be mob connections actually mm-hmm. interests them further.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you make of that?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. My family has been passing down this story, I think, as a way of shaping their own identity mm-hmm. as Italian Americans. And I think the stories that we tell ourselves about our families really do shape our identities in a lot of ways. You know, it's a way to say, I'm from this place. And also, you know, I'm of this culture that may be a little dangerous, that may be a little titillating. I mean, I know that my male family members have really enjoyed the mafia aspects of the story, whereas my female family members really enjoyed the witch aspects of the story.
Well, can I ask, though, about the mob part of it?
Yes.
Because I could imagine, I'm not Italian American, mm-hmm. but I could imagine being like offended by the consistent portrayals of Italian Americans as connected to the criminal underworld.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe in some ways your family members are offended by some of those portrayals, but not all of them. Help me understand that mm-hmm. from the perspective of you and your family.
Oh, I will tell you, my family members are not offended by it at all. My dad, who sadly passed about 7 years ago, he loved this story and he was mm-hmm. obsessed with this story. And he was a very boring claims attorney who loved The Godfather yeah. and loved The Sopranos. And I think that American culture and media has really glorified that, has glorified the idea of the mafia. But if you go to Sicily, it is not glorified. And that mm-hmm. is the big difference. And that's a big thing that we'll get into in the podcast. I went to their No Mafia Museum last time I was in Sicily, and they don't call it the Mafia Museum. They call it the No Mafia Museum because it's about getting rid of the mafia.
Wow. It's so fascinating. And you kind of wrap that into the book as well. I want to talk about your dad a little bit because mm-hmm. I too listened to the first episode of the True Crime podcast. It's funny. It's riveting. It's titillating. It's like you almost paid homage to your dad. We always have these stories in our individual families and we ignore them usually when we're young. And then we get of a certain age and then we're like, start following the breadcrumbs. What was that like for you? And did you feel like you were getting closer to your dad the closer you got to the outcome of the story?
Yes. Yes. In so many ways. I just want to scream. Yes, yes, yes. So as I said,
feel free, by the way.
Yes, yes, yes. I promised you guys I wouldn't get too Sicilian American with my hand gestures here. So my dad loved this story and he was sick for a long time. He had muscular dystrophy at the end. I mean, he was bedridden for about 7 years. And I think that exploring this family history was a way for him to escape that bed. And I knew that he loved it. We talked about it, but not nearly enough because I was living my own life. I was living in New York. I was trying to find a partner. And then I got married and got pregnant. And then he was gone. Then he passed away and we didn't really get to talk about it. And he also always wanted to be a journalist and writer, but felt like he had to be a lawyer. He had to do something, you know, that was more sensible. And so in a lot of ways, I feel like I'm fulfilling his legacy by telling this story in both genres, in both the fiction and the nonfiction. And I've been able to grieve him in a way that I couldn't when he passed, because I was newly pregnant with my first baby. I was newly married. I had just lost my job. I didn't have time to grieve. And I've been able to sit with him and to sit with his memories. And I felt him really close to me, both while I was writing the book and then also while I was investigating the podcast for the past year. And it's been a really beautiful thing. And I'm not very woo-woo about many things. I'm a very rational person, but I've got to tell you, This book flowed out of me like nothing else. And I think it's because Lorenza, my great-great-grandmother, and so many of the women whose stories are lost to history want their stories told. Mm. Yeah. And it really felt like that while I was writing.
And did anything surprise you about yourself or about your ancestor, Lorenza Marsala, when you were following the trail?
Oh my God, so much too. So when I first heard the story about Lorenza, so it's miraculous to me because a lot of my family members didn't even know her name.
Yeah.
They just knew, they're like, oh, we have this great-great-grandmother or great-grandmother who was murdered in Sicily. And that was kind of their tie to Sicily in a way, but they didn't know anything about her life. And I really wanted to dig into what her life was like. The first big surprise was when I got her picture. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I had in my head, I'm like, she is like an Italian grandma. She is cooking sauce on the stove, you know, wearing her apron. And I saw this picture of her, and she is fierce.
Mm-hmm. Cheekbones.
Those cheekbones that could mm-hmm. cut glass. And I mean, she looks like a woman who would take you down. And I'm like, okay, do not mess with her. And that was the first surprise. And then the next surprise was, you know, I go over there and I find out how she lived. She wasn't just patiently waiting for her husband to return. She was alone there for 12 years, but she also wasn't alone. She lived on the same street as her sister and her parents and her family, and she was working. She was one of the cool things I discovered in my reporting last time I was there. I just got back. I was there 3 weeks ago. Is that she was buying and selling land. Mm. I found these deeds with her name on them, not her husband's name. And I don't know if she was ever planning to come to America because she bought her own parcel of land 3 years before she was murdered.
Stay tuned for the next episode. But I want to, before we close, Joe, I just want to talk about you a little bit because you mentioned your dad maybe had some aspirations to be living this creative life that you are living now.
Mm-hmm.
You have a fascinating career to me. You've written I don't know if my numbers are exactly correct, but like about 7 books. Mm-hmm. You've been involved in like 7 podcast projects. You're big in sort of the parent influencer community.
3 kids.
How do you approach having a self-sustaining career as a creative person today? Because it just seems like you've got octopus arms in everything. How would you explain to folks how you have, you know, ended up as an omnivorous content creator type person?
That's such a great way of putting it. I have to say, I think it's because you have to in this media landscape these days.
You can't just sit back and write your book in one room and just put it out to the world.
No, I mean, the 90s would have been really nice, is what I'm saying, okay? Yeah. That would have been beautiful. I came up right before newspapers really went online in earnest. You know, I started at the New York Daily News in 2002, 2003. And I just watched everything change over and over again, first every year and then every 6 months. And I think it's taught me that nothing stays the same. And if you want to remain a creative person in the world and a storyteller in the world, you have to constantly pivot and try new platforms. So I switched pretty early to digital and then doing social and video. And I did podcasts about 7 years ago, which you all know, NPR and WHYY have been doing essentially podcasts forever.
Yep.
But that was kind of like the new renaissance of podcasts and loved it. And now I don't even really consider myself just an author. I say that I'm a storyteller, and you have to figure out where to reach people where they're at. So that could be audio. That could be social media. I did not expect to be a person that is, you know, parenting influencer adjacent.
Yeah.
But it is a good place to tell stories and to reach readers. And so I'm constantly reinventing myself. And I plan on doing it until I burn out and try to become a commercial pilot.
Well, relentless experimentation. I love it.
The book is fascinating. The podcast, definitely worth a listen. All of it's coming out. And all a different story on each platform. So congratulations to you.
Thank you so much.
That is Joe Piazza, author of the new novel and true crime podcast, both called The Sicilian Inheritance. You can download the latter wherever you get your pods. You can pick up the book wherever you get your books, which is now on a million platforms as well. So it all comes back to the same place. We got to be everywhere all the time, Cherry. But thank you, Joe,
for
joining us today on Studio 2.
Everywhere all at once, guys.
Everywhere all at once.
I love that. And that wraps up our show today, friends. Our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered the show today from Studio 2. in Philadelphia. And WHRY, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman-Aaron. How do you say goodbye in Italian?
You say ciao.
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 I should know that. Ciao, everybody. Ciao. We will see you tomorrow.